From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. And President Donald Trump is addressing a joint session of Congress tonight. It's not a State of the Union, technically. Presidents only give those once they've been in office for a year. It's been a rocky first month for Trump. His approval rating is at an historic low for a new president. But the president told Fox and Friends this morning he's taking bold action and all is well.
I mean, there are those that are saying that I've done just about more than anybody. Now, when you add our health care that's going to be coming out soon and will be a really good health care as opposed to Obamacare, which is a total mess. If you add the tax cuts that we're going to be doing as soon as we finish health care, that'll come out very soon. The big tax cuts for business and for people, for middle class, tremendous cuts and for everybody. I think that, you know, I think I've done just about more than anybody in the first 4 weeks.
To look ahead to tonight's big address, let's bring in NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon, Eric.
So the president today in that Fox interview also said he would give himself an A grade for his presidency so far, but a C for messaging. He's got a chance to reset that messaging tonight, yeah?
Absolutely. But, you know, the C for messaging, it's kind of an interesting admission from Trump, who doesn't often, admit flaws. Quite frankly, sounds a lot like Barack Obama when Obama, you know, was under fire for some of his achievements, and like the stimulus, for example. And he said, well, you know, I think it was a crisis of messaging. It was a problem or that they didn't sell it well enough. So often when presidents have their backs against the wall, they will blame messaging. And certainly Trump has an opportunity tonight to lay out some of the things that he would like to do in a little bit clearer way than some of the chaos that you've seen roll out so far from this first month of his presidency.
Well, let's talk a little about tone. I mean, in his inaugural address, he painted kind of a dark picture of America. He talked about, you know, this American carnage. What do you expect from tone-wise tonight?
It's hard to say because, you know, his White House is billing this as something of an optimistic speech. But, you know, it's hard for me to believe that he's not going to talk about making America great again, right. Sticking to the message that he won on. And that's wasn't exactly an optimistic, you know, message that he was selling. He was selling a message of carnage and destruction and a mess that he inherited and that he's going to look forward. So the White House has also said that they expect that the president will talk about where we've been and where we're going. So I think it's going to be one part, look how bad everything was. Another part, I can fix it.
And we should note that the White House also said the inaugural was going to be sunny and it was pretty dark.
So. Yeah.
So Trump's speeches during the campaign and really, Domenico, now as president, have been pretty light on policy specifics. Can we expect any new details tonight about health care and what the GOP might do to replace Obamacare?
I think that's highly unlikely. I don't really think that that's Donald Trump's strong suit. He doesn't talk about granular details of policy in a real kind of clear way. It's not the way he lives. It's not something that he thinks about deeply. It's the way he ran his organization, where he's big picture. He talks about maybe the site of where a golf course could go or the size of a building. But then most people figure out the stuff, the micro pieces of it. And then he comes in later to say, I don't like the color of that carpet. So I think it's very similar to what you're seeing with how he's let things run in this first month, where he's had people create the frameworks of these policies, create the details of those policies. And then he feels somewhat blindsided when the rollouts don't go necessarily as perfectly as he would have liked.
Right. Let others deal with the details. Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan spoke with reporters briefly this morning. Let's listen.
We can fix our health care system so that costs go down and choices go up. We can fix our broken tax code so that rates go down and growth goes up. We can fix our regulatory system so that it protects us instead of punishes us. And we can secure our border and rebuild our military for the 21st century.
Domenico, the Republican-led Congress and Trump haven't always been on the same page these first 40 days. I mean, Ryan there sounds pretty much in line with Trump's priorities. Are we seeing Republicans starting to come together?
You know, for the most part, that's true. I think that the biggest sticking point continues to be entitlement reform and Medicare or Social Security, for example. Donald Trump really wants to sort of leave those alone. You saw that his budget priorities didn't touch those programs, but he wanted to increase military and Homeland Security spending at the expense of things like the EPA, the State Department, education. And I think Paul Ryan would prefer to change Medicare and Medicaid, how that's structured, block grant to states, save money in the budget that way to pay for other kinds of buildups like with the military. But Donald Trump didn't campaign necessarily on cutting Medicare and Medicaid, and that is something that is still going to be something of a sticking point for this Republican majority and this Republican president.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thanks as always, Domenico.
Thank you.
Well, one topic that may come up in tonight's speech is Chicago, and not in a good way. The president has been pointing out the level of violence in that city again and again, tweeting just the other day that Chicago is totally out of control and needs help. And here he was last week speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
I mean, can you believe what's happening in Chicago as an example? 2 days ago, 7 people were shot. And I believe killed. 7 people. 7 people. Chicago, a great American city. 7 people shot and killed.
Danny Ecker covers tourism for Crain's Chicago Business, and he joins us now. Danny, what's happened to tourism in Chicago with all that President Trump has said about how dangerous the city is?
Well, so far, nothing. You know, Chicago is actually coming off of its highest visitation number, tourism number ever. 54 million people came here last year. Now, you know, this has been a relatively fresh thing that the president has been tweeting about and attacking Chicago and, you know, saying it is a war zone and you can't walk around the streets here safely. So there's certainly some talk among the tourism stakeholders here about what to do about this. Is this going to have a big effect? But so far it hasn't shown to be, you know, preventing people from booking hotel rooms or canceling trips, canceling trade shows and conventions. So far, it's really done nothing.
Well, I have to say, though, anecdotally, I was speaking to someone recently who has never been to Chicago, and I said that I was going to Chicago for the weekend, and he said to me something like, isn't that dangerous? Is it okay to go to Chicago? And I think, of course, it's fine. You know, certain areas of Chicago certainly are dangerous, but most of the Chicago that any tourist would go to are fine. It must not be helpful to the image.
No, certainly not. And you're exactly right. I mean, you could say that kind of thing about most major cities. Certainly, you know, it shouldn't be understated. This is the city's biggest problem. You know, I mean, the murder rate here was the highest last year. It's been in almost 2 decades. But, you know, to perpetuate the idea that this is some sort of war zone and that also that it's easily fixable, as the president has, I mean, it's unfounded. You know, this is people who live here. This is not news. Unfortunately, you hear about this stuff in the certain pockets of the city. But people are around here every day, walking around, feeling safe and enjoying the tourist hotspots every day.
How do the people of Chicago feel about these constant attacks from the president?
You know, I think most people are just sort of looking at him and saying it's more of the same. Remember that this is overwhelmingly anti-Trump town. You know, 85% or so of Chicago voted against him for president. So, you know, for most of the time, I think it's people here are saying this is really obnoxious that he's doing this because it certainly does affect the perception of the city, and especially for those who maybe don't know Chicago that well and might believe that, yes, this is some sort of dangerous area to be at every day. You know, that can have an impact on businesses and you know, people that rely on visitation here, on the conventions and tourism, but it hasn't yet. So I think most people are just kind of looking at it and saying, you know, he's wrong, but what are you going to do? I mean, they kind of hope that he'll self-implode the more he does this.
And what should we make of the fact that the Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, boycotted this meeting at the White House with the other governors the other day? You would think that he and Trump would go along together pretty well.
Yeah, you know, and it's been interesting because Governor Rauner has not, you know, been aligned very closely with the president. I really think he recognizes, and for those who don't know, Governor Rauner actually was instrumental in building the Tourism Bureau here in Chicago before he was governor. So that issue is very relevant to him, and Chicago is very important to him. And I think that he certainly recognizes that there are some very misleading statements and mischaracterizations that the president has made about Chicago and about Illinois, and whether or not he's trying to send a message by boycotting that meeting, I don't know. But he certainly has plenty of reasons to oppose his tweets and his random attacks on Chicago.
Is the tourism organization there, Choose Chicago, saying or doing anything to try to counteract these messages?
You know, they're not, and I think that's the idea here. If you ask the new CEO, who's been there less than a year of Choose Chicago, you know, the best way to battle back against this is to ignore it. There was a meeting recently among the big hotels here in town, and that came up in the discussion, and they said, well, what do we do? Do we need to start to kind of reinforce our brand, address these types of attacks? He said, ignore it. The more you address it, the more you put a spotlight on it, and the more it can be perceived as reality. You know, and we'll see how long that lasts. But I think from a tourism branding perspective of the city, they're trying to say, you know, we're going to keep doing what we're doing and promoting our city and the highlights we have here. But this is not something we need to address, because those of us who know the city know that these are unfounded attacks and claims.
That's Danny Ecker, who's a reporter at Crane Chicago Business. Danny, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
The FBI and Justice Department are investigating bomb threats at Jewish schools and community centers around the country. The Anti-Defamation League reports there have been 90 bomb threats since the beginning of the year. Just yesterday, there were 20 threats to Jewish centers and schools in a dozen states, including Alabama, Delaware, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Thankfully, no bombs were found. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, the threats came less than 48 hours after more than 150 gravestones were toppled by vandals at a Jewish cemetery in Philadelphia. Police believe the vandalism took place either late Saturday night or Sunday morning. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf called the vandalism a cowardly, disturbing act and vowed to find those responsible and hold them accountable. Avi Wolfman-Arendt of Here and Now contributor WHYY visited the cemetery and filed this report.
As a news helicopter circled overhead, Mark Levin wove through the tombstones of Mount Carmel Monday afternoon. Like so many canvassing the cemetery, he was looking for a family gravestone. In his case, that of his parents.
It's right around here somewhere.
They came in somber succession, each praying they would find stones still upright and intact. Levin's mother and father both served in World War II. He'd hoped the vandals would see the military insignia on the graves and spare them. They didn't.
God, I was coming here, just open it.
As his unfinished thoughts drifted into the breeze, Levin looked down at a double headstone lying flat against the earth.
What can you say? Just ignorant people. Very ignorant people that do things like that.
An administrator with the cemetery counted 150 damaged headstones as of midday Monday. As families assessed the damage, reports rolled in that three Jewish community centers and a school in the Philadelphia region were evacuated due to bomb threats. All of that was top of mind Monday afternoon as a group of faith leaders gathered in Germantown to condemn the acts. Among them was Bill Worley of the United Church of Christ.
It will not, that expression of hate, make America great, but the compassion, the unity, and the community that stands on this stage will.
Police have not yet announced suspects in either the bomb threat or graveyard incidents. There is a $13,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the Mount Carmel perpetrators. For Here and Now, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
On September 16th, 1408, Sigurd Bjørnsdóttir and Thorstein Olafsson got married in a church on the southernmost tip of Greenland. They'd settled there after their ship was blown off course as they sailed from Norway. Greenland had already been home to a Viking colony for more than 400 years when they landed. Their marriage was mentioned in letters, including one in 1424, but that's the last anyone really heard from the Norse Greenlanders. Archaeologists and historians have long debated how and why the Vikings perished. Was it climate change, the Black Plague in Europe, economic collapse? In the March issue of Smithsonian Magazine, journalist Tim Folger writes about new research into that question. And Tim Folger joins us from Gallup, New Mexico on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thanks very much, Eric.
And Tim, first, tell us more about this couple I mentioned in the introduction. They represent Viking life on Greenland toward the end of their reign there, yes?
That's right. That couple, Sigurd and Thorstein, as you said, were married in the early 15th century in a church that was built, you know, more than 100 years before Columbus sailed to the Americas. The Vikings settled Greenland during a period that was unusually warm by historical standards. Scientists call it the medieval warm period, and it lasted from about 900 AD to 1200, and it made sailing to Greenland from Scandinavia much easier than it had been in the past, and much easier than it would be in later centuries.
So tell us about this medieval warm period. I mean, why did the Vikings settle on Greenland in the first place? It was just easier to get there and easier to farm and have livestock during this warmer climate?
It was easier then than it would be later. According to the old sagas, Eric the Red reached Greenland in 985, and he described it as, he supposedly named it as Greenland, as a way to entice settlers there. But, you know, a lot of archaeologists really question that rationale for settling Greenland. Why would you leave, you know, Norway, travel over Arctic seas to settle in a land that is much more difficult to farm, a much more challenging environment? So what was it that really brought the Vikings to Greenland? It probably wasn't good farmland. It might have been that the Vikings were searching for wealth. They were looking for walrus ivory, which is a really valuable commodity in medieval Europe.
And you write, the Scandinavians had this, you know, remarkable ability to colonize these high-altitude places, graze livestock, and build a life in you know, inhospitable areas.
You know, one archaeologist really kind of brought the magnitude of their accomplishment home to me when he compared the Viking experience in Greenland with the experience of the British settlers in New England. You know, the Pilgrims, when they arrived in at Plymouth Rock in 1620, they barely survived their first winter. They probably wouldn't have made it if they hadn't received help from Native Americans. 500 years earlier, the Vikings settled in Greenland with no help from any native peoples, and they managed to survive and farm there. And, you know, who could even do that today? We think, who has that set of skills to build ships, sail to a place, farm and hunt in these Arctic conditions? It's really an amazing accomplishment.
Tim, after 1424, there's no more word from the Norse Vikings. And the conventional theory has been that they failed to adapt to climate change and either packed up and left or died off. Tell us what your piece argues.
Over the last several years, archaeologists have pieced together, you know, a much more interesting and complex picture, that the Vikings were actually really well adapted to life in Greenland. They were hunting seals very efficiently. They were farming very carefully. They conserved their soil. So it probably wasn't their failure to adapt to a changing climate that did them in, which is kind of a scary story in a way, because they were doing a lot of things right, and yet they still didn't succeed.
The impact of the Black Plague and of climate change on the Viking population has been studied and talked about more. But you mentioned that less studied and less well-known is the impact on their trade, globalization, and the collapse of the walrus ivory market. Tell us about that.
Archaeologists now think that a more plausible reason for the Vikings settling in Greenland was that they were going after walrus ivory, which was a very valuable commodity in medieval Europe. And that trade in walrus ivory sustained the Vikings' Greenland colonies for probably 400 or 500 years. But eventually that market collapsed as new trade routes were opening up into sub-Saharan Africa by the Portuguese and other countries. And they were bringing elephant ivory into Europe. Elephant tusks are much bigger than walrus tusks. It was much easier to work with. Going to sub-Saharan Africa was much easier than sailing to Greenland. So kind of the market fell out. The demand for walrus ivory plummeted, and their economy collapsed, it seems.
There's no evidence that the Black Plague reached Greenland, but it reached Norway and did enormous damage to their trading partners across Europe.
That's right. You know, there's no evidence of any plague or any sort of widespread disaster in Greenland. So archaeologists have debated, well, what happened to the Vikings in the end? Did they intentionally leave in an orderly way, or did they, you know, meet some horrible fate? Did they starve to death, or were they wiped out by, you know, conflict with the Inuit who were coming down from northern Greenland at about the same time the Vikings were settling in Greenland in the south?
The fate of the Vikings has been seen as something of a cautionary tale about a society failing to adapt to climate change. But as you mentioned, this is far scarier. This is a culture, it seems, that did adapt and do the right things to try to adapt to a warming climate, and they failed anyway.
That's right. It is a much scarier story. I think they were doing a lot of things right. They were conserving their soil, adapting to a local habitat, and still they couldn't survive. in a way, they were doing much better than we are. You know, we can foresee problems in our future. The Vikings didn't have that luxury. They couldn't see what was going to happen in to the climate in the decades ahead. We can see that. Mm. The Vikings didn't. But even so, they did everything that a culture could at that time to adapt, and they still didn't make it. And that is scarier. And it's, what sort of message does it have for us today when we're probably not making the same sorts of efforts that the Vikings made to adapt?
Tim, why is knowing what happened to the Vikings important to us?
I think it's important because they face the same sort of challenges we face: globalization, climate change, potential pandemics in our future. And they faced all three of them at the same time. It's a warning for us, I think, that we can't ignore these threats. If we do ignore them, we do that at our peril. We have an advantage over the Vikings. We can see that the climate is going to change and that we should be preparing for it.
Tim, by the way, what happened to that Viking couple who got married in 1408 that we started the interview out of? Do we have any idea?
We do. There's a record from 1424 that mentions that the couple eventually settled in Iceland. And as some sort of property dispute, perhaps, they needed to provide evidence that they had been married in Greenland. Hmm. And so the letters testifying to their wedding were preserved in Iceland. So we know that at least those two people made it out of Greenland alive.
Tim Folger's story about why the Vikings vanished from Greenland is in the March issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Tim, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Eric.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
It's Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday. Around the world, revelers are taken to the streets for parades and carnivals, celebrating the last day before the Catholic and Protestant Lenten season. And here in the U.S., New Orleans, of course, is hosting the big party, the birthplace of jazz and home of the beignet. There's a lot of drinking going on in New Orleans today, but what do people there like to eat on Fat Tuesday? We're going to check in now with Poppy Tooker, native New Orleanian and host of the public radio show Louisiana Eats. She joins us by Skype. Poppy, happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras. Happy, happy. This is the day we all wait for.
Awesome. So the parades and parties are underway there. What are people eating today when they're not drinking?
Well, you have to understand that there are some people who spent the night on the medians getting ready for the big day. They were probably drinking beer and eating king cake all night long waiting for the parades.
King cake is like a fried dough?
No, a king cake is a special brioche sort of a cake that is eaten from January 6th when the Mardi Gras festivities kick off on the Feast of the Epiphany. And it's a braided oval cake decorated with purple, green, and gold, the colors of Mardi Gras. It has a baby hidden inside because whoever gets the baby either gets to be the king or queen of the party, or more often, you have to buy the next king cake. And there's king cake in offices every single day in New Orleans. It's a tough thing we do here.
So if you get the baby, you got to buy the next king cake or the next round of drinks.
Something like that.
A lot of sugar on the king cake there. So people like to eat up some of the fatty foods, as I understand it, before the Lenten season begins. But I've been to New Orleans a bunch. They eat fatty food year-round down there.
Well, you know, you've got to often have a little fried something to absorb all that alcohol. Because the other thing that's going on this morning, by about 7 o'clock, the people on the streets were toasting with brandy milk punch. Sometimes you'll see bottles of champagne and deviled eggs and poor boy sandwiches and lots of fried chicken. A recent phenomena is you can go up and down St. Charles Avenue, and on that broad median that we call the neutral ground where the streetcars run, you'll see people turning a whole pig on a spit today for a big Mardi Gras meal.
What about for those folks in the parades? They have something there eating special?
Well, the folks who are in the parades, usually there's a tradition of before they board the floats, there is some sort of elegant lunch that they attend or a breakfast. Other than that, you're going to find a lot of little party sandwiches and a lot of beer.
Papa, you know, this is a live show at lunchtime. We don't get a real lunch break. Could you send me up a fresh beignet, a coffee, and maybe a shrimp po' boy?
Absolutely. Or how about an oyster po' boy? That's what we had yesterday.
That sounds great.
It was pretty good.
Poppy Tooker is host of the radio show Louisiana Eats. Poppy, thank you, and happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras. Thanks so much.
President Trump is expected to talk national security in his first joint address to Congress tonight. Yesterday, he received the Pentagon plan he had requested for one of the major security challenges he faces, the war against ISIS. The plan could eventually involve sending more American troops to Syria. It also calls for squeezing ISIS finances and limiting the group's recruiting efforts. President Trump also said yesterday he wants to boost spending on the military by $54 billion. Here he is speaking to a group of the nation's governors.
We must ensure that our courageous service men and women have the tools they need to deter war, and when called upon to fight in our name, only do one thing, win. We have to win. We have to start winning wars again.
Military analyst Andrew Bacevich is a professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. He's also a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam, and he joins us. Professor, welcome back.
Oh, thanks very much.
And President Trump has said that before, that the U.S. doesn't win wars anymore. But in the case of a war against ISIS, this is a terrorist group. There's not going to be a signing ceremony or a victory celebration at the end of it. What do you think when you hear him say that?
Well, it affirms my belief that he's unqualified to be commander in chief. I mean, the question, I think, that we should focus on is the question of why don't we win, and will simply shoveling more money at the Pentagon produce wins, produce victory? And I would have to – I'd have to hear the argument that would persuade me that that's the case, and I don't think any such argument exists.
And what about the plan that the president has just gotten to defeat ISIS? It may include more U.S. troops in Syria. What do you think of it based on what you know about it at this point?
Well, I think the campaign against ISIS is succeeding. Now, success is coming incrementally. Success is being achieved at enormous cost, particularly to Iraqi forces. But it's happening. Whether or not adding a handful of additional American troops, whether that will accelerate the pace of success, I don't know. I suppose it will. But I think the larger point is it really begs the larger question, which is not simply what do we need to do to defeat ISIS, but what can be done, what should be done to address the larger problems that afflict the region. And I'd argue that ISIS really is a symptom of the larger problems. So people talk a lot about military strategy as if sending an additional brigade of U.S. forces to the region is a strategy. It's not a strategy. There is no strategy. There's not even a discussion of strategy, as far as I can tell, in the foreign policy establishment.
But when you say the larger problems affecting the region, what are you talking about?
Well, I think what I'm talking about is political dysfunction, economic underdevelopment, high levels of corruption, an absence of opportunity for young people as they come of age, meddling by external forces, for example, Saudi Arabia and Iran, that each have an agenda of their own, and it's an agenda that does not contribute to restabilizing the region. Were we to actually have a strategy, then that strategy would have to address those kinds of problems.
And it sounds like you're saying that strategy would probably come from the State Department, not the Defense Department.
Well,
right?
It certainly would be a strategy that would have to encompass many more things than simply military operational considerations.
When it comes to the military, though, let's talk about this proposal to increase military spending by $54 billion. That's about 10%. I want to play you a clip here and ask you about this. This is President Eisenhower in his farewell address on January 17th, 1961.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Now, it's hard for many politicians probably to argue against an increase in defense spending because who doesn't want to have a strong military, the strongest military on earth? But what about that in the context of what President Eisenhower warned about so many decades ago?
Well, he was right. There is a military-industrial complex. The clout that the military-industrial complex exercises today is not as great as the clout that it exercised back when Eisenhower was in office. That is to say that military spending is a far smaller part of both our national economy and a smaller proportion of the federal budget. But there's no doubt that corporate interests, in particular corporate interests that are invested in maintaining high levels of military spending, are going to get attended to by people in Washington far more than the voices that are calling for improvements in public education or investments in health research.
So is it a mistake then to do this, to increase military spending at the expense of these domestic programs?
I think so. But again, the kind of question is, what for? Why do we need to spend an additional $54 billion? Where will that money go? How much of it will go to the purchasing costly weapons as opposed, for example, to improving the readiness of U.S. forces that have been abused and misused over the past 15 years and therefore probably need a certain amount of attention in order to get them back up to speed. But the larger question has to be toward what end? What is the strategy? What is the problem that spending an additional $54 billion a year is going to solve?
One of the things that I've noticed as I've spoken to military analysts, even military analysts who believe, as you do, that Trump is not qualified to be commander in chief, is that they're still happy with the people that he's put into these big national security roles. H.R. McMaster as national security advisor, Jim Mattis as secretary of defense. What do you think of his team at this point?
Well, I think that individually, people like Secretary Mattis and General McMaster are seasoned, talented, capable, well-intentioned. But as a matter of course, I'm opposed to having our senior national security position so dominated by military officers.
Why?
I think that it chips away at the principle of civilian control. And that's something that's a principle that Americans take for granted. And I think that actually President Trump's infatuation with military officers and his propensity to put them in these senior positions is actually indicative of the way that we are losing sight of the importance of that principle. You know, we're a country of, what, 325 million people? Seems to me that there are some folks out there who haven't spent their life in uniform that actually probably have the qualifications to serve as defense secretary, to serve as national security advisor. And I, for one, would like to see those positions filled by people who have lived their lives, have their professional lives in the civilian world rather than in the military world.
One more question, Andrew Bacevich. There are going to be Pentagon investigations into the U.S. ground raid in Yemen that resulted in the death of a Navy SEAL as well as several militants, and also the U.S. military says more than 20 civilians. Some are saying there should be a congressional investigation into this. Do you think that it needs to be investigated?
Well, there should be an investigation, not in particular because a Navy SEAL lost his life, however tragic that is. There should be an investigation because the operation failed. And there ought to be an objective, detached inquiry into any military operation that goes badly. I don't know that that means that the investigation ought to be conducted under, you know, Klieg lights in public, but there should be an accounting.
You say it failed. The White House is saying it was a success because a lot of information was gathered.
That's what they're saying, but I don't know if that's the case. I don't have access to the information that supposedly was garnered.
But you say it was a failure because?
What I understood the mission to be, they didn't accomplish the mission.
That's Andrew Bacevich, who is a professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Indian relatives of two Kansas shooting victims, one of whom died, are urging fellow Indians not to send their children to study in the United States. The shooter allegedly yelled, "Get out of this country," as he opened fire on the two software engineers at a bar south of Kansas City. More than 1 million international students currently attend American colleges and universities. More than 160,000 of them are from India, second only to China, with more than 300,000. The vast majority of foreign students have a positive experience studying here. But Trump administration policies toward refugees and immigrants, and now this racially charged shooting, are prompting some foreign students to think twice. Esther Brimmer is executive director of the Association of International Educators, a nonprofit dedicated to international education and exchange. She joins us now from NPR's studios in Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Start by telling us, what are you hearing? Are more students from India and China questioning whether Trump's America is a hospitable place?
We have been hearing from our members that there's a great deal of concern about studying in the United States. Indeed, that there are families who have seen these news reports. And it's a tragedy in that sense, because across the United States, colleges and universities want to welcome international students. But the recent news reports have raised concerns, as have recent actions by the administration.
What reasons are they giving? The administration's pledge to build a wall, the now stalled travel ban, is it all of it?
There's several sets of concerns. The first set was the executive orders that were promulgated by this administration by banning people from the seven countries. Everybody from those seven countries was affected. It meant that there were students and scholars who were split up from their families. And people saw this. We had scholars who might have gone to conferences. They might have gone home to see their families. We had cases where a mother, who was a PhD student, went home. She wasn't able to get back to see her family. We had people going to conferences who all of a sudden were stranded outside the United States. There were approximately 17,000 students from those countries affected. But also concerns that other countries would be added to the list. And then even beyond that, concerns that this was evidence of a changing attitude in the United States towards international students. And while there's been some relief with the judicial action that has paused this, there are people who are worried that if they come to the United States this year, maybe next year they won't be able to get another visa. Maybe they might be stranded in their second or third year, not able to complete their program. And finally, the actions on immigration, because there is a connection between the United States policies on immigration and its face to the world. Is it seen as welcoming?
Right. And we should say the Trump administration is poised to propose a new travel ban executive order coming later this week. Anecdotally, Dr. Brimmer, we're seeing reports that more international students are looking at blue states or to Europe or Canada. Are there any numbers to back that up that you're seeing?
As you've indicated, this is actually an especially difficult time because colleges have issued their invitations to students to come and study. So students both in the United States and internationally are making their decisions. Several educational associations, including ours, NAFSA, and others, are working together to conduct a survey this spring to get more information from admissions officers so we can understand what we're happening. At the moment, the United States is the leading destination for international students, but we are losing market share. Increasingly, students are recognizing they do have choices. Some students may choose to go to Australia or Canada or other countries that also have excellent institutions. We may be losing them for years. If they don't come this year, they're not coming for, let's say, the next four if they're an undergraduate. So a decision made now by an international student can have long-term consequences for that student, for the students who would have worked with that person, and for colleges and universities across the United States.
Dr. Brimmer, foreign students often pay full fare. That helps subsidize U.S. students. Isn't there a potential huge economic impact of all this?
Indeed. While we stress the intellectual impact, there is an important economic impact as well. There are over 1 million international students and their families in the United States. And that group of people accounts for over 400,000 jobs and over $32 billion worth of economic activity in the United States.
Beyond the economic impact, what's the value of having international students on campus?
For decades, the United States has recognized that by having international students here, we benefit from the exchange of ideas, from bringing together smart people, which fosters innovation, which helps the United States economy. But also, international students affect our informal ambassadors. People around the world who have studied in the United States usually go home with a positive view of the United States. They learn more about the United States. And as they go on to their careers, and many of them have careers as diplomats and business leaders, they retain that positive view of the United States. So there's an important intellectual benefit, economic benefit, but also a long-term political and diplomatic benefit for the United States of having international students come study here, benefit from the United States, and create those international links which are helpful in the future for decades to come.
Esther Brimmer is Executive Director of the Association of International Educators. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.